Hello, welcome to Visionary Spaces, Psychedelics, Creativity, and Play. This episode is with Ilum Aynan. I've known Ilum for about a year now. When I first met him, he was emaciated, really bad shape. He was at the top of this sacred site at the top of this mountain that we sort of just ran into him. He had been at the tail end of a 40-day fast. My intention was to talk to him about the fast and what his purpose was, what he learned, and all that kind of stuff. However, he was not really excited to talk about that. However, he did talk about a lot of interesting things in this episode, and I think there's a lot to learn here about connections between great spiritual leaders around the world. And then he also talked about his spiritual practices, what he does, and how he connects to the great consciousness. So I think Ilum is a great, great, great teacher, and I appreciate the time that I got to spend with him, and I look forward to the next time that we meet. Ilum, hope you're well, and I hope that you all enjoy this episode as much as I enjoyed creating it. Thank you, and until next time.
Visionary Spaces, Psychedelics, Creativity, and Play, with your host, Michael Puente. Conversations with masters of the visionary space.
I am here with Ilum Aynan. I met Ilum a year ago at the Camino Sagrado retreat down in Sacred Valley of Peru. We found Ilum on top of some ruins. He had been fasting for 43 days, and he had on a water fast in water and sunlight. And he was just basically a bag of skin and bones when we found him. And we brought him down to the retreat center. He's been living here ever since, helping and taking care of people and being a really a source of light for people to and laughter, because he's a funny guy. funny guy that, you know, brings a lot of smiles to a lot of people's faces. So, hello, Ilum. How are you?
Good, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's really been a pleasure to get to know you this week.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you wanted to talk about, first thing you want to talk about was awakening to our own divinity through plants.
Sure. If we take a look at myths concerning just about every megalithic structure, it tends to be a myth. For example, in Mexico, Central America, there's myths, Mayans, Aztecs witnessing dwarfs that built their pyramids and megalithic structures by singing these rocks into existence and into place, or at least their form. We have another myth that's similar with the Great Pyramids in Egypt. There's a myth that the priests sang those pyramids into place. And we have examples of Tiwanaku, wherein the sculptures that have been carved out in Tiwanaku in Bolivia, which is a megalithic ruin, in the hands of Witakocha, you find two apparatus. And these apparatus are DMT snuff boxes. And so we have this connection between singing, plant medicines, or DMT, and creativity. It's quite possible that prehistoric civilizations, the records of which that have been mostly destroyed by the flood, had the ability to create and tap into their divinity at a deeper level because of training, knowledge that was not being hindered, and a lack of prohibition on those plants and on those properties that allowed us to access our divinity, or do allow us to access our divinity. There's all sorts of amazing examples in the plant worlds as well. For example, like ayahuasca, the tradition that I've been trained in, which is a Shipibo tradition, there's a phrase that they'll sing when they're singing to ayahuasca, and it's soma. Soma Moraya. Moraya is, it's like the highest level of healer. It's one of the highest levels of healer. Soma. Soma Moraya. Mantakuna. So here we have this word, soma.
Yeah, it's in the East also.
Yeah, and I've asked these maestros, What is soma? We don't know. That's what they say. We don't know. But it is quite possible, you know, 50,000 years ago, up until I think 12,000 years ago, Egypt was a rainforest. So it's very possible that this word that these indigenous tribal shamans, these medicos, these healers use, associated with the ayahuasca, happens to be the exact same word that the Greeks wrote of as the elixir of the gods. And if Egypt was a rainforest, in the archaeological records, it was not a desert. The plant life was incredibly different than what it is right now. So we have these connections between the plants, between cultures, between myths of creation. And I don't think it's a mistake that they're prohibited.
So that the plants are prohibited?
Yeah, I think it's
the Western world, you mean?
I think it's calculated. Absolutely.
What do the plants do for us in terms of
well, I mean, you don't actually need the plants to do this. Mm-hmm. You can do this through meditation and spiritual practices. Or I don't know if I'd even call them spiritual practices, but your own awakening practices. But the plants do help. And they help open that gateway into your divinity. And when you have that connection, when you really have that connection, beyond knowing and beyond a doubt, when you just are in that moment, completely connected with everything, and the realization arises within you, that's awakening. It's awareness. It's oneness. And it's the most powerful gift and the most beautiful blessing, and nobody can ever take that away from you. But it's addictive as well, because it's a state that you would like to be in more frequently than not. So I don't see people addicted to DMT or psilocybin, because we all know that those can be incredibly difficult experiences.
Yes.
I do see people addicted to longing for oneness in their own divinity. Mm. Mm. And I think it's a healthy addiction, if we're going to use that word. Yeah, there's true magic in this world, for sure. And I do believe, you know, as the native North American natives say, Wakan Danka, the great spirit, created all the plants and put medicine in them for us. And I do believe that they are just about the best access that we have into ourselves.
Do you want to talk about the Andean cosmological system and its connection to the Gnostic?
Sure. Yeah, it's very interesting. It's all theory, but I think it's a theory that's worthy of some introspection and analysis. We have myths of Quetzalcoatl and Viracocha. Viracocha is Andean for God. It's the Andean word for God. Mm-hmm. Quetzalcoatl was a god that visited the Aztecs. We'll start with Viracocha. We have a story of Viracocha. And maybe it's just myth, but there's a lot of similarities that join up with scriptures given in the Gnostic, especially the Nag Hammadi codices. It's a very interesting time. So Viracocha, for the Andean nations, was God. And there is a myth that he was incarnated God. That he was dressed in a long white robe, had a beard, long hair, carried a staff, and was depicted wearing sandals and with one foot over the puma as a sign of conquering violence. He was a god of compassion and love. And ironically, we have the same depiction of Quetzalcoatl, who visited the Aztecs in Central America. I'll start with Viracocha. Viracocha was living as a resident in Tiwanaku. In Tiwanaku, there's very good evidence that Tiwanaku was pre-flood. I believe there's blocks that are carved perfectly that are 400,000 ton megalithic blocks. And Viracocha was living in Tiwanaku in Bolivia, in this archaeological complex, and I believe he came back to rejuvenate knowledge in the people. And this, by the way, is who is depicted in these statues holding these DMT snuff boxes as well. And so Viracocha is the original Inca. Inca means leader. And the Viracochas were the residents of Tiahuanaco. It's interesting, why would the residents of Tiahuanaco be called Viracochas? If the name Viracocha means God, why would the residents of this city be called gods? Because they were being awakened to their divinity through deep spiritual practices. And so there was no savior. It was a group of gods working as one, awakening, teaching. The story with Viracocha, and this story applies to Quetzalcoatl, is that at some point a dark energy came along, a malevolent energy of death and obscurity, and there was a supposed wrestling, and Viracocha left. He went through the valley, north, up over the mountains, and across the ocean. Before he left, we have a prophecy here in the valley. It's over 2,000 years old, and it's called the Prophecy of the Eagle and the Condor. And the Incas say, when the eagle flies with the condor, the world will change. So the Viracochas, the residents of Tiahuanaco, when Viracocha left, came up through the valley and rejuvenated the Quiros and the Quechua and the Amiari, the tribes, the indigenous tribes, and unified them into the Inca nation, or the nation of the leaders. The Viracochas were the leaders that came through and taught the people their agriculture and their astrology and their science and their spiritual practices. And there's records of those spiritual practices here still today in the Quiro nation, who live up in Asangante. They lived so far back and so far, so high, in such a hostile and cold environment on the side of Asangante Mountain that the Spanish never went back there. There was no desire. There was no gold. There was no power structure. It was just a local band of, as far as they were concerned, peasants. Mm. But these peasants are actually the original keepers of the knowledge of the Inca. And so if you go to Cusco today and you ask the Cusqueños, what are the three Incan laws? They're going to say, don't steal, don't lie, and don't be lazy. But those are not the three Incan laws. Those are the laws that were twisted through the contamination of the Spanish over 500 years of
conquest.
Yeah. So the three Incan laws that the Quiros have that were never contaminated by the Spanish are completely different. They're beautiful. Yachay, which means the wisdom that comes when we open our heart to all experiences, the perceived negative and positive, knowing that it's all serving you, that it's all perfect. And this is a great wisdom that comes to the heart, this Yachay. We would know this as faith, more or less, as a way to describe this more complex description. Munai, which is love, unconditional love. Yankai, which is service. So anything you do, any work you do, any act you do, it should be done with all of your love and all of your devotion to the divinity within everything, the others that you're serving and yourself and the environment around you. It's all full of divine spirit. What's really ironic is these three laws. We have the universal law of Aini as well, which is a karmic reciprocity, and that's a law that nobody escapes. It's just a law that is. Yes.
It's there.
It's there. What's really interesting is, you know, when we look at the Gnostic scriptures and the Nag Hammadi codices, which is a group of books that were found in Nag Hammadi, Egypt, in an early Gnostic Christian tomb, most likely copies of original books that were destroyed after or during the process of the creation of the Bible in 325. Any book that was contrary to the story that was being put together by the Roman Catholic franchise was destroyed. And these are most likely those copies. These are books that have direct teachings from Christ. These are books that have incredible advanced knowledge and teachings that were reserved for his disciples. And these are books that the Roman Catholic Church does not want you reading for a reason, because they teach looking for the one, the divinity within yourself, and not looking for it outside of yourself. So in these books, there's one in particular called the Apocryphon of John that's really interesting. It has a completely different story on creation than we've been told. It's completely different than Genesis. And it's Christ returning to John as a resurrected Christ and teaching John about where we come from and who we really are. And he teaches a story where he tells John, I came to Adam and Eve in the form of an eagle, and I landed on the tree of knowledge and told them, eat from this tree. This will rejuvenate what you've lost. And John counters and says, but I thought it was a serpent that taught them or told them to eat from the tree of knowledge. And said, oh no, the serpent told them to eat from the tree of sexual desires so they would be slaves to him. So we have Christ documented, if you believe John, if you believe disciple John, if you believe the Acts of John and St. John and Apocalypse in the Bible, if you believe any of that, then you should probably at least examine the Apocryphon of John, his other writings, his most powerful. Apocryphon means secret book, so this is the secret book of John. We have a documentation of Christ arriving as an eagle. And then what's more interesting is in the Nag Hammadi scriptures, we have the three parts of the word that are carried by the Son, because our Father is always in silence and the Son carries the word. That's faith, love, and works, which are exactly in uniform with the three laws of the Inca. So here, okay, we have this prophecy of the eagle and the condor. Check. We have the description of Viracocha. Very Christ-like description. Check. We have the Inca laws that line up exactly with the Gnostic scriptures. Check. We have Apu Con Titi. Apu is divine spirit. Con is the primordial source. T is sun, so TT is the sun behind the sun. This is the great cosmic central sun, the root of all incorruptible light. It really lines up with a lot of the words that are used to describe our Father. I think the biggest misunderstanding that happened between the Jesuits and the Andean nation was the arrogance that blocked them from taking the time to learn the words of the locals. Because if they'd learned the words of the locals and the concepts, for example, Pachamama. Pacha is space and time, mother. It's the mother of space and time. It's not actually the representation of the earth, the dirt itself. It's the representation of the divine feminine that's in all of it, the Holy Spirit, the Pachamama, the mother of all space and time. So we have these concepts that actually really do line up and have created a giant void between the Catholic Church and the Pachamama Mamestas. Which is really quite sad, because I think all humans are really actually searching for universal truth, and to have that sort of division does not help anybody. What's really cool about this story, and keep in mind, this is the God that's been engraved in stone with DMT snuff boxes in his hands. Mm-hmm. I mean, even as an incarnate, it's depicted that this God was snuffing DMT to access higher realms. And the same story applies to the priests that build the temples and the pyramids in Egypt. They had access to acacia. We don't know what plants they had, actually. I mean, because the earthscape of Egypt has changed so drastically from when the pyramids were actually functioning. There was actually like a super advanced empire there. But we know they've got acacia.
And mimosa, or what's the other one? Syrian root.
Yeah. And so there was a chance, we could theorize that there's a chance that they had ayahuasca at one point, or something very similar. It's ironic with the word soma. Yeah, and with Quetzalcoatl as well. Interesting story with Quetzalcoatl. Quetzalcoatl is the return of the dawn, the feathered serpent who came to the Aztecs. And from my understanding, Quetzalcoatl as well had this same description as Viracocha. You know, bearded man, did not fit in with the locals, looked different, incarnated God or divine being who had interdimensional gifts, certainly, who came to the Aztecs and taught them, you know, agriculture and astrology and advanced mathematics and science and the sanctity of marriage. Because at this time, these indigenous Aztecs were savages. I mean, to the furthest extent of the word, group orgistic sex, human sacrifices, pretty savage people. And Quetzalcoatl came to them and rose them up, rejuvenated them. Very similar to Huitecoche with the Huitecoches in the Incan Empire in the Sacred Valley of Peru. And his description was very similar. And there's a story with Quetzalcoatl who decried or denounced human sacrifices and taught against it, that the spirit, the Great Spirit, did not actually want sacrifices, blood, neither human nor animal, that a song was preferred. But there's a similar story with this energy, this dark energy, this energy of death, this energy of obscurity coming in, and Quetzalcoatl wrestling with this energy and then leaving as well. And the myth is that before Quetzalcoatl left, he told the Aztecs, "I will be returning. And I will return at this location and on this date. And if you do not follow my teachings, I return in the form of death." So what happens? It was the 1500s, the Aztecs, I can't give you the exact date at this point. The Aztecs are all lined up on the beach, waiting for the return of Quetzalcoatl. And here comes Fernando Cortez with the Spanish conquistador armada. And they arrive, and of course they're welcomed with open arms, because these people are expecting Huitecoche, and to have a bearded man with a sheet of with an armored chest plate, and you haven't seen this incarnated God for hundreds or thousands of years, you're going to expect that this is Huitecoche, because he meets the description.
Quetzalcoatl.
Thank you. Quetzalcoatl, because he meets the description. And the Spanish conquistadors massacred the Aztecs carrying a giant cross with the depiction of a crucified Christ upon it. So Quetzalcoatl had returned in the form of death, misconstrued teachings of Christ, the vicious atrocities that have been done against our indigenous brothers through that same name. But we're talking about plants here. So we'll get back to the plants.
Oh, we're talking about the Andean cosmological system and the connection to the Gnostic.
Yeah, I kind of went into that with Huitecoche a little bit, and some of the laws of the Inca. What's really interesting is for the Andeans, for the Incas, for the Quiros, Quechua, the residents of the Sacred Valley in this region of Cusco, who have these advanced spiritual practices that were passed on from the Huitecoches or from the Incas, the sun takes a great importance. Explain to me that the Inca did not revere the sun itself, that their prayers were not given to the sun itself. The Inca viewed the sun as a portal, as an access to the sun behind the sun, the great central sun, the root of all incorruptible light. And they gave their prayers to the light, their reverence to the light. The sun just happened to be, in this dimension, the greatest example of that, the source from where we could perceive it. And I believe the same was with Kemetic practices or Egyptian. I think there was perhaps a misunderstanding of the importance of the sun and the sun gazing. It's really interesting, all of the archaeological complexes that are left in the valley, well, not all of them, but a majority of them are built on the top of these mountains. And what we would consider to be a hostile environment, you have to ask, why would they do that? Well, I mean, there is the argument of defense. It's definitely easily defended up high. More interesting, we find in their archaeological complexes in Intihuatana or a hitching post of the sun. In every single one of the complexes, there's a hitching post. So they had spiritually and astrally and ethereally connected the energy of the light that comes from the sun, from behind the sun, into their society, to help them, guide them, to protect them, to strengthen them. And I think it's worth noting, there's incredible benefits to sun gazing. Incredible benefits. It's truly a medicine.
Is that one of your personal practices?
Yes, this is one of my personal practices.
So what is sun gazing?
Sun gazing is the practice of taking your shoes off, wearing no socks, grounding with your feet into the earth, and looking into the sun as it rises first thing in the morning. And it's typically safe for the first 20 minutes and the last 20 minutes of the day, while the sun has a slight color to it, to, you know, yellow to orange to red. It's safe to look directly in the sun. It's not going to cause damage. Most people can't start this practice for long periods of time. They're advised to start for 30 seconds to a minute at a time, build up until they can handle the experience. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guarantee it'll help anybody. It'll fill them with more light, more energy. They won't need to eat as much to receive energy.
What are the other practices?
Prayer work with water. We know that we can change water, the structure of water, based on just our thoughts, just our consciousness. It's probably the easiest element to work with our consciousness. And so, yeah, by doing prayer work over water and the sun, you can basically create your own medicine. So, yeah, these are my practices. Walking barefoot, I don't do it all the time. I have a pair of really comfortable flip-flops that occasionally make it onto my feet. But I do try and walk around barefoot as much as possible. I find that it's a great practice as far as bringing oneself into the present moment, into the present awareness, keeping our thoughts centered, grounded. It helps to calm the mind and quiet the mind, especially when you're walking over rocks that don't feel so good. You're going to have a hard time thinking about just about anything else.
Yeah. Do you have a message to the world?
Our message to the world, it's time people, or all of us, realized that we are one, truly. And we have these ego meat suit structures. We have ego superstructures with governments and churches and religious divinations and racial barriers. And they're really not serving anybody. They're being intentionally manipulated to keep people from waking to their own divinity, to keep people from looking inside. There's a reason that society keeps us so busy, mentally, emotionally, physically. It's to keep us from taking that time to connect into the divinity within all. I find a lot of people get really threatened at the idea of Viracocha, of Christ, in reality. And here's my example. I really feel that if somebody came back as Christ and said, hey, here I am, 90% of the people would not accept it because it would threaten their own ego structure so much to know that there was somebody awakened who saw them as a reflection, saw them as equals, perhaps in a state of dormancy or sleeping, but saw them as equals and saw himself inside of all of them and vice versa. I do believe people would be heavily threatened by that person, even if that same person was teaching them that they are one, all of them, and doing their best to awaken those people. Mm. And I do believe we are our own saviors. I believe the message of Viracocha, the message of Quetzalcoatl, the message of Christ, the message of Buddha and Krishna was that you are all. And that's the great secret. And we find that secret inside ourselves. We unlock that secret inside of ourselves every time we come into union with the divine feminine, the divine masculine. When we are in that vibration of love, that frequency of love, unconditional love, a love that nothing can ruin. And when we work in that vibration of love, opening our divinity with the sacred plants as well, we become that. And that's why I feel that there's so much prohibition upon those plants. There's an energy that does not want humans to awaken to their divinity, to know that we are all connected and that we are all one. But it's a beautiful experience, priceless.
Yeah.
And I hope all of the world will have that experience soon.
I hope so too.
Mm-hmm.
I hope so too. All right, I think this was a beautiful conversation, Elon. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
I love you. I appreciate you.
I love you as well.
It's been an honor to hang out with you these last 9 days.
Yeah. A great honor. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And thanks for indulging me with this conversation.
Absolutely.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Visionary Spaces. The mission of Visionary Spaces is to spread the wisdom of the masters of the visionary space. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe, and better yet, give us a 5-star review. Getting great reviews really helps our mission. If you know of a guest who would be a great addition to this podcast, please send me an email at info@lessonslived.com. That is, again, info@lessonslived.com, and make sure to put Visionary Spaces in the subject line. Until next time, I wish you well.